Good evening, everyone. My name is David McKnight, and I'm the director of the Rare Book and Manuscript Library. It's my pleasure to welcome you to the second installment of the 2011 Rosenbach Lectures in Bibliography and Book History. As many of you know, we've had to evacuate the sixth floor of the Rare Book and Manuscript Library because of we're under construction. Due to the scheduling difficulties of maintaining this room for three nights in a row, we have shifted the third and final lecture of Alberto Manguel's Rosenbach this year to the class of 55, which is on the second floor of the Van Pelt Dietrich Library Center. The third lecture is on Thursday evening, March 24th at 5:30. So I apologize for the inconvenience, but we're shifting across campus. Tonight I have the privilege of introducing Mr. Derek Dreher, who will introduce Alberto Manguel this evening. For those of you who do not know Derek, he has been the director of the Rosenbach Museum and Library since 1998. He has an MA in the History of Art from Yale University and is a summa cum laude graduate of Princeton. A Fulbright scholar, he was awarded a Kress International Research Fellowship for research in Germany. A specialist in graphic arts, of the Renaissance, he has published on a variety of subjects, including prints and drawings ranging from Dürer to Daumier. In addition, Derek serves as the chair of the Philadelphia Area Consortium of Special Collections Libraries. He's the chair of the executive board. Please welcome Mr. Derek Dreher, who will introduce our speaker this evening.
Thank you very much, David. Good evening, and welcome to the second of three ASW Rosenbach Lectures in Bibliography for 2011. Those of you who were here yesterday, and I do recognize many familiar faces, know that if I say we're at approximately nel mezzo del cammin, that's a meaningful statement. There's something about which we can reminisce, in other words, but there's also more adventure still to come. Let me first take a quick step back to introduce you to the Rosenbach Museum and Library. And by the way, there's a radiator pronunciation thing going on here. We just won't worry about that right now. The Rosenbach was the brainchild of Dr. A.S.W. Rosenbach. It is a very stately historic house here in Philadelphia. It's filled with very stately collections, focusing largely on English literature and American history. And it's a place we try to create the most unstately programs you can possibly think of. What I mean by that is we view it, simply put, as our highest duty to place the collections given to us into the hands of others. We do that figuratively through exhibitions, classes, and seminars. We do that literally through hands-on tours and research services. If you don't know us, I hope you will accept my invitation to come and see us sometime soon. Why is there a museum and library in one place in Philadelphia and a lecture series in another, both bearing the same name? Well, why not when it comes down to it? Penn can think of 1928 as the year that a 1901 PhD in English, Dr. A.S.W. Rosenbach, endowed a lecture series. The Rosenbach can think of 1928 as the year that same PhD purchased at auction Charles Dodson's original manuscript for Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. And in a way, the sales and the purchases that he transacted ultimately came to benefit both institutions. Penn and the Rosenbach have been collaborating in more ways than I could possibly enumerate for decades, and I know that will continue for decades to come. I'm particularly grateful that David McKnight has invited me to give these words of welcome this evening. Dr. Alberto Manguel, in case you weren't with us last night, is a writer, translator, and editor, and I might add a philosopher in the broadest sense of that word. He's also a traveler's traveler. He's lived and worked in many, many places across the world. He's the author of numerous books, of which I will mention this evening only that several of his recent ones are devoted, broadly speaking, to the topic of reading. In his talk last night, he characterized the reader as traveler and took us along on a journey that extended from the Epic of Gilgamesh to the Torah to Augustine to Dante to Mallarmé and even into electronic texts. It was quite a journey. It was compellingly and eloquently presented, and I know we're in for a similar treat tonight as Alberto speaks about the reader in the ivory tower. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Alberto Manguel.
Thank you. Yesterday, I talked about the reader as travelers, one of the metaphors that we use to try and understand what it is that we do, we readers. Today, I've chosen another of these metaphors, the one of the ivory tower. I'll begin with a character that is familiar to most of us. As the bodies pile up and the tragedy approaches its close, before renouncing forever the power of speech, the mortally wounded Hamlet addresses his friend Horatio and begs of him, "If thou didst ever hold me in thy heart, absent thee from felicity a while, and in this harsh world draw thy breath in pain to tell my story." Hamlet's dying wish is twofold, that Horatio set down in words all that has taken place, and that he do this in studious isolation, giving up his carefree existence, drawing his inspiration, his breath, from the harsh world itself. Both actions demand that Horatio return to the past, to go over the events the audience has just witnessed, thus obliging Horatio to become, as it were, the declared author of the play, and in order to do so, to dwell in the sorrowful moment in which the tragedy concludes. In effect, Hamlet asks Horatio to withdraw from the world of idle pleasure, felicity, which in the 16th century carries the connotation of material contentment and prosperity, and concentrate instead on intellectual labors that will honor Hamlet's own life. Like Hamlet, Horatio is a young intellectual, a word that acquires its modern meaning in Shakespeare's time, a student at the University of Wittenberg, who, in spite of confessing to a truant disposition, is undoubtedly a scholar. Friends, scholars, and soldiers, Hamlet calls him and Marcellus. Recalling a 1929 production of the play, John Gielgud observed that in the moving and convincing opening scene, the sentinels on the tower, old and bearded veterans, terrified at the ghost of their old master, showed innocent trust in the wisdom of the young student Horatio. Horatio, says Gielgud, was cleverer than they and would interpret their fears. Now, such trust in the intellectual power was, in Shakespeare's time, as in all ages, not unqualified, and scholars were regarded with a mixture of awe and suspicion. A scholar like Hamlet had no real knowledge of life, and yet clung adamantly to his philosophy. Hamlet knows not seams. "'S blood," he says of the murky affair. "There is something in this more than natural if philosophy could find it out." Well, the if is rhetorical. Hamlet is convinced that philosophy can find it out. In the world of the Danish court, both soldiers and courtiers think of Hamlet as a sort of bookish fop, mouthing the wisdom of his books. Hamlet, like Prospero, is supposed to know things only because of his books. And if deprived of these magic amulets, he would lack his vaunted superhuman powers. Remember, says Caliban to the sailors, trying to convince them to murder Prospero, first to possess his books, for without them he's but a sot, as I am. Though we may like to imagine Shakespeare on the side of Prospero against the brutish Caliban, as we like to imagine him siding with the Prince of Denmark against his murderous uncle, Shakespeare was not an absolute defender of the cloistered intellectual. Intellectual pursuits for their own sake are praised ironically in his plays, from the pompous shallows of Jacques' rhetoric, or from the heights of Sir Nathaniel's dismissive haughtiness when criticizing poor Dull to the pedant Holofernes. Sir, he hath never fed on the dainties that are bred in a book. He hath not eat paper, as it were. He hath not drunk ink. His intellect is not replenished. He is only an animal, only sensible in the duller parts. Arden is all well and good, and Rosalind and Orlando can play their games there. But it is in Duke Frederick's court that true power is held and the course of things determined. Prospero is master of dreams and spirits on his island, protected and guided by his reading. But the reality is that he's a deposed governor leading an imaginary life in exile. I saw once a wonderful production at the Old Vic where before the play, Prospero is shown as a what looks like a deposed Latin American dictator and is sitting there, and then the play begins. It's a kind of wishful idea of what he would do if. And Hamlet, the studious prince, is the outsider in the tangled web of Denmark's politics, whom King Claudius, for whatever private reasons, wants to force into action, to break his passive disposition by sending him to England, to expel this something settled matter in his heart. In fact, Hamlet and his college friends either act wrongly or do not act at all. The example of getting down to business is given by Claudius, by Gertrude, or even by the king's ghost, or by the pompous Polonius, while Hamlet and his comrades are, in the less noble sense, men of words. Laertes is another matter. He stands somewhere between the two, neither an active character in any full sense, for all his jumping into graves and unsheathing swords, nor a dithering literary gentleman for all his outraged rhetoric. Laertes serves, on the one hand, as a board on which his father Polonius can sound his advice for getting on in the world, for being a man of proper action. And on the other hand, Laertes is a mirror for Hamlet and his doubts. "Show me what thou'll do," Hamlet shouts at him. Although, as Northrop Frye pointed out, there is nothing appropriate for Laertes to do at this point except kill Hamlet. Laertes is a man of little action and few words. In the early Middle Ages, the man of words, meaning the scholar of scripture, was praised as a man of virtue. Thomas Aquinas, in one of his early sermons, noted that, according to Augustine, one skilled in words should so speak as to teach, to delight, and to change. That is, to teach the ignorant, to delight the bored, and to change the lazy. Augustine argued that words offered us the possibility of higher understanding by means of that which memory culled from the texts read. Reading, above all, allowed for a space in which the mind could detach itself from its quotidian surroundings and dwell on loftier matter. not consciously decoding the text on the page, but rather allowing the text to transport us on an inward journey. Though Augustine believed that only with the resurrection of the body could a state of ultimate bliss be achieved, something like that state was possible for the earthly traveler, a moment of illumination granted by the act of reading. For Augustine, reading and writing were divine gifts or obligations imposed upon Adam and Eve for their first disobedience, so reading and writing as a punishment. Before the fall, they communicated without language, from soul to soul, and after the last trumpet, when language once again would no longer be necessary, reading and writing would vanish from the earth. But while we are of this world, words remain our only necessary and humble inheritance. According to Augustine, positive action in this world could be effected through reading, through the passing from the words on the page to thought and to the realm beyond thought, to understanding the evidence, as St. Paul called it, of things unseen. The meditative life was the better life, as Christ himself pointed out to Martha and Mary. To his fellow students, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, Hamlet points out that only thought defines the world, lending it understanding. For Hamlet, being in Denmark stifles his ability to think freely. Not so for Guildenstern and Rosencrantz, who enjoy their status as guests of the court. "Why then, 'tis none to you," Hamlet answers, "for there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. To me, it is a prison." Such nihilism, to use an anachronistic term, was scorned by Shakespeare, for whom the world, as his writing of course shows, is of unimpeachable reality, not subject to the whims of philosophical lucubration. Things may seem, in fact do seem, one way or the other, but blood and stone and human passions and the world itself have a solid existence that, to follow Augustine's story, we have been condemned to translate into words in a pathetic attempt to apprehend them. It was Coleridge who began the tradition of seeing Hamlet as a man paralyzed by excess of thought. According to Coleridge, in The Student Prince, Shakespeare, I quote, "seems to have wished to exemplify the moral necessity of a due balance between our attention to the objects of our senses and our meditation on the workings of our minds, an equilibrium between the real and the imaginary worlds. In Hamlet, this balance is disturbed. His thoughts and the images of his fancy are far more vivid than his actual perceptions, and his very perceptions, instantly passing through the medium of his contemplation, acquire, as they pass, a form and a color not naturally their own. Hence we see a great and almost enormous intellectual activity and a proportionate aversion to real action consequent upon it, with all its symptoms and accompanying qualities. This character Shakespeare places in circumstances under which it is obliged to act on the spur of the moment. Hamlet is brave and careless of death, but he vacillates from sensibility and procrastinates from thought, and loses the power of action in the energy of resolve." Coleridge was not a bad critic. Hamlet has been warned of the consequences of allowing thought to override action. His father's ghost, you'll excuse me for quoting Derrida, but which Derrida cannily defined as this non-present present, this being there of an absent, which defies semantics as much as ontology, psychoanalysis as much as philosophy. Then this ghost, then, is the paradoxical reminder that there are more things in heaven and earth that are dreamt in both Horatius and Hamlet's philosophy. The ghost is the incarnation of unreal reality, of that which lies beyond the margins of Hamlet's books. To experience it, the ghost is referred to as a thing, of course, not a person. To experience it, Hamlet must pass from the concreteness of printed words to the evanescent evidence offered by the world. Were Hamlet not to act, the ghost tells him, he'd be duller than the fat weed that rots itself in ease on Lethe's wharf. But this is exactly what Hamlet has to do. Lethe, the river of Hades that offers oblivion, was for Virgil a necessary passage for the souls before their reincarnation. In order to act in the world, Lethe must cleanse Hamlet of his intellectual impediments. To learn something new, decisive action, something old must be forgotten. The earlier philosophy must be purged. This is something that Augustine, attempting to reconcile scripture with his old love of the pagan classics, the fact that he weeps for the death of Dido, would have understood well. It is not that Hamlet decides not to act. It is that, stuffed with academic teaching, he will not allow himself to unlearn his university catechism and learn again from the factual experience of what has suddenly broken into his consciousness. Because the appearance of his father's ghost is more than just a nightmarish prodigy in Hamlet's life. As Shakespeare makes it clear, it is the beginning of the undermining of Hamlet's entire intellectual universe, of his ethical and moral learning, of his confidence in the reality of what is told in books. As a student, his library was his whole universe, his entire experience of the world as library, which he later sees as a prison. And this may be one of the meanings of that famous utterance: I could be bounded in a nutshell and count myself king of infinite space, were it not that I have bad dreams. For Hamlet, as for Prospero, both bounded in their nutshell libraries, the real world, the world outside books, is an imprisoning nightmare. In this sense, the ghost of Hamlet's father appears as a terrifying liberation. The ghost demands that Hamlet close his books, step out of the confining space of words, and face the painful facts which, like that of his too solid flesh, refuse to melt. Hamlet, the ghost tells him, must remember his father, the murdered king, and not the baser matter of books. Thus Hamlet is brutally confronted with a reality, or rather an unreality that is more real than real, that replaces the trivial fond records his studies have taught him, a worldly reality that overrides the wordy lessons of his books and tables. Now, these tables, as you know, were habitually kept by students in Shakespeare's time, commonplace books in which they were supposed to copy out inspiring examples and moral teachings from the classics. But these must now be replaced by the bloody teachings of his father's ghost. Remember thee, Hamlet asks in response. Yea, from the table of my memory I'll wipe away all trivial fond records, all sores from books, all forms, all pressures past that youth and observation copied there, and thy commandment all alone shall live within the book and volume of my brain, unmixed with baser matter. He can't refrain from using the bookish metaphor even for that which won't be a book, which is his his brain in the experience of the world. Faced with the ghost and its explicit revelations, Hamlet realizes that he must descend from his ivory tower and act. But how should he act? Why is his behavior so puzzling to the other members of the court, each interpreting the prince's actions according to his or her gullible or guilty eye? Tom Stoppard in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead has one of his clowns sum up the situation. He addresses Hamlet and says, "Your father, whom you love, dies. You, as his heir, you come back and find that hardly was the corpse cold before his young brother popped onto the throne and into his sheets, thereby offending both legal and natural practice. Now, why exactly are you behaving in this extraordinary manner?" In fact, as the audience impatiently realizes, Hamlet is not behaving at all. Perhaps Coleridge's accusation of procrastination is too strong, but the fact remains that after five long acts and many terrible events, Hamlet still has not relinquished words for action. He has not left his ivory tower for the public forum. He dies, but even that is not a wordless event. At the end of the play, the rest is certainly not silence. The term ivory tower used to denote an intellectual sanctum, a place of refuge and alienation from the world, is a recent one. In the beginning, it carried no negative connotations. In 1837, Charles-Augustin Sainte-Beuve, perhaps for the first time, used it to contrast the abstract poetry of Alfred de Vigny with the more politically engaged of Victor Hugo, imagining the ivory towers a bookish sanctuary, a place in which the intellectual could work quietly and effectively. And he says, "And Vigny more secretly, as if to his ivory tower, returned before noon." Sainte-Beuve was not a great poet. This is the ideal that Jacques Le Goff saw developing much earlier in the Middle Ages, the ideal of Thomas Aquinas, an ideal that led to the foundation of universities and libraries as centers of study, in order not to escape from the world, but better to reflect upon it. According to Le Goff, sometime later, when the medieval intellectual began to relinquish the closed-in circles of reading and prayer, I'm summing up things very quickly here because it's a lecture and not a book, but forgive me, I'm going quickly through this progression of the intellectual. But Le Goff says that when the medieval intellectual began to relinquish the closed-in circles of reading and prayer and entered the spaces of empirical science and political life outside the university and monastery walls, another group of readers took on the role of secluded scholars. And what Le Goff says is that humanist is an aristocrat. At once the humanist takes on the wit, the spirit as his ensign, even as he languishes over his textbooks and his eloquence smells of the midnight oil. He writes only for initiates, so that when Erasmus publishes his adages, his friends tell him, "You reveal our mysteries." This is the world of the student Hamlet and of his friends, the closed academy of mysteries that are not revealed to the uninitiated, the privileged world of grammar and gown. In Oxford, for example, students and masters claimed the privileges of ecclesiastical jurisdiction, and the chancellor ensured for the university such a position of independence that it was said that the burghers lived in their own town almost as helots or subjects of a conquering people. It's perhaps exaggerating things, but In France, things were different. Le Goff notes, since the centers of study never achieved a similar degree of separation from the town, so that when the humanists reached Paris, they did not teach at the university, but in an elitist institution, the College of Royal Readers, the future Collège de France, which remains an elitist institution. Everywhere in Europe, the humanists worked in silence, hiding the fact that they worked at all, boasting of their leisure, of the otium of the ancient Romans. Do not be ashamed of this illustrious and glorious idleness which great souls have always enjoyed, wrote the 15th century theologian Nicolas de Clamange to the scholar Jean de Montreuil. Hamlet, like Prospero, believes that this otium, this leisure, will allow him to be a better man, to reign perhaps one day as King of Denmark, as Prospero reigned as Duke of Milan, and again, like Prospero, finds that the world is nothing like the hortus conclusus of his library. How weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable, he says, seem to me all the uses of the world. Of this world. Fie unto it, ah, fie. 'Tis an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely. As a Shakespearean scholar Jonathan Bates notes, Shakespeare has a more practical mind than Prospero and Hamlet. His dramatic art translates a theme of ancient books from the vita contemplativa to the vita activa by virtue of his very medium of production. Unlike the private contemplative space of the library, the public sphere of the theater belongs to the active life of the citizen. The humanist defense of theater against Puritanism, this is still Bates speaking, was that the theater had the capacity to bring to a wider public the kind of moral edification that was available privately and selectively to elite humanist readers by means of their book learning. For Shakespeare, who was not a university man, the concept of the ivory tower from which Hamlet refuses to emerge was one to be scorned. And yet, as another scholar, Nuttall, has asserted, it is hard to think of anything in Hamlet of which we can be sure. For the successive generations, Hamlet's refusal proved difficult to accept, perhaps because it reflected other uneasy refusals which his audience was unwilling to recognize. From Coleridge's reading onwards, attempts were made to rescue the prince from his tower, to show that the scornful confinement was not, in fact, something that had fully seduced him. On April 23rd, 1940, the German drama critic Wolfgang Keller addressed the German Shakespeare Society with these words. Outside, in and over the wild North Sea, our brave forces in fearless vessels or in roaring planes are attacking the British warships and their hiding places. The British, who allied with our indefatigable enemies in the West, are waging a war of annihilation against us. We, however, celebrate Shakespeare, a son of English soil. But can we? Well, apparently they could. Two centuries earlier, Johann Gottfried Herder had noted Shakespeare's roots in Nordic poetry and proposed the idea that, born in England by mistake, Shakespeare was in fact German. Following on Herder's claim, Keller noted that Germany had been the first European country to translate Shakespeare. This was Brock's translation of Julius Caesar in 1741. And with this act, Keller argued, the Germans first rose to claim their right to Shakespeare. Furthermore, Keller went on to say, two centuries of German critical work on Shakespeare had given Germany the right to rate the greatest dramatist of the Germanic tribes as a German classic, which no British policy can ever steal from us. To justify this claim, Keller pointed out the similarities he perceived between Elizabethan England and the Third Reich. The sense of life of the Elizabethans, Keller wrote, was heroic, military, young, and striving for progress, hungry for actions and adventures. But the main reason Germany itself had so far not produced a Shakespeare was clear. Shakespeare's England had been free of Jews for 300 years. Hamlet was the Third Reich's favorite Shakespeare play. Between 1936 and 1941, the Berlin Staatstheater staged Hamlet almost 200 times. One of the most noted productions was directed by Lothar Mittel with the celebrated Gustav Heinrich Gründgens in the title role. Gründgens was perhaps the most famous actor in German theater history. He became known for playing Mephistopheles in Goethe's Faust, and later, as you know, he was a subject of Klaus Mann's Mephisto. Klaus Mann was his brother-in-law. He married the Mann sister. And Klaus Mann depicts him as someone ambiguous towards the Nazis, if not a Nazi sympathizer. However, Gründgens played Hamlet against the traditional expectations. Instead of the uncertain, reflective intellectual, Gründgens's Hamlet is depicted as brave and determined and anything but hesitant. In the words of Gründgens's biographer, Kurt Ries, a new Hamlet is born, one that has not been seen before. A Hamlet full of responsibility, a Hamlet ready to act and not afraid to play the fool. To achieve this, any lines that suggested passivity were cut and scene 4, act 4 was deleted in its entirety. For Rees, other Hamlets could ask themselves whether they should act or not. For Gründgens, there was no such question as long as the regime of terror existed, as long as criminals ruled. Now, this is an ambiguous interpretation of Gründgens's interpretation of Hamlet. In a startling paradox, the actor with Nazi sympathies depicted his hero as a resistant against tyranny. The tyranny was Danish in the text, but Nazi in the eyes of a discerning audience. No contemporary costumes were needed to signal this comparison. Gründgens wore a wide-collared cape and a hat with a vertical brim, more a foppish Wittenberg student than a warrior prince. And yet, apparently, the effect was that of powerful action. Gründgens himself wrote to one of his critics trying to explain this interpretation of Hamlet, and he said, when the curtain rises, I don't want to play Hamlet. Hamlet does not want to play Hamlet. I want to go back to Wittenberg. It is against my will that I am burdened with a truth I cannot withdraw from. I want to act, but I must know. Otherwise, I can't act. Philosophical reflection is for Gründgens's Hamlet not a self-serving indulgence, but an intellectual function that leads forcibly to action. In Gründgens's interpretation, the ivory tower becomes not a sanctuary, but a watchtower. The notion of the retiring intellectual was likewise recuperated for different reasons, with different arguments, by Marxist thinkers. Antonio Gramsci, more vigorously than others, saw the intellectual's role as the opposite of Hamlet's, not waiting and reflecting, but setting out and exploring and deciphering the intricate problems of society and having an active hand in the passage from capitalism to socialism and the running of a socialist state. Not only a revolutionary elite, but the whole reading public consciously exercising its intellectual talents. Gramsci was deeply interested in the role of the intellectual in society. For Gramsci, I quote, "All human beings are intellectuals, but not all have in society the function of intellectuals. That is to say, not everyone has a social intellectual function. Each existing social group creates within itself one or more strata of intellectuals that gives it meaning, helps to bind it together, and helps it function, whether they are managers, civil servants, clergy, teachers, scientists, lawyers, doctors, and so on. For Gramsci, the intellectual does not belong to a separate social class, but acts within a specific class according to that class's needs. Thus, Hamlet acts within the circles of the intellectual royalty and cannot conduct itself according to the manners of the military aristocracy, like Horatio, or the political bourgeoisie, like Laertes." In his prison notebooks, Gramsci distinguishes between organic and traditional intellectuals. Organic, of course, in the sense of forming part of the organ, and in intellectualists in the traditional sense of something separate. And both seen by society to belong to two different categories. The organic intellectual seems explicitly to be part of a particular social class allied to and assisting the ruling class, a product of the official educational system taught to perform a function for the dominant social group. It is through this organic intellectual that the ruling class maintains its hegemony over the rest of society. And following this definition, the social theorist C.L.R. James observed that in Shakespeare's time, the intellectual was an organic part of rationalist society, and that Hamlet is the organic intellectual. This for James. The traditional intellectual, instead, is defined by Gramsci as independent of any specific social class. As men of letters, religious thinkers, essays, and poets such as Erasmus or Shakespeare, they appear as autonomous and independent individuals, part of a lineage unbroken by strife and social upheaval. This curiously rejoins certain ideas about universal poetry, either by Shelley or by Valéry, the idea that all poems have been written by one Holy Spirit or Muse, and that poets just attach their name to whatever portion of that universal poem they have written. And Gramsci's idea of the intellectual seems to belong to this notion. The intellectual, the traditional intellectual, continues a tradition throughout time and is represented at different times and different places by different individuals. In the hands of these was the task of countering the official common sense. And these traditional intellectuals, according to Gramsci, participated, I quote, in a particular conception of the world, had a conscious line of moral conduct, and therefore contributed to sustain a conception of the world or to modify it, that is, to bring into being new modes of thought. Gramsci asks a question, a fundamental question. Is it better to think without having a critical awareness, or is it better to work out consciously and critically one's own conception of the world? Gramsci's words unconsciously echo Hamlet's more famous question, which still remains unanswered. The verb to be carries in English a double meaning, which is rendered explicit, for instance, in Spanish. Ser, meaning to exist, and estar, meaning to be in a certain manner or place. Of course, both exist, coexist in to be. But Gramsci's dichotomy offers Hamlet two distinct possibilities: to reside in his library tower, a reader for whom the limits of his reading coincide with the margins of his books, or to take his reading into the world, to confront the book in his hands with the book of the world, as Augustine suggested. In Shakespeare's time, the yet unnamed ivory tower, praised as a sanctuary in the Middle Ages, was commonly derided as a refuge for cowards. Centuries later, as we have seen, after Sainte-Beuve had invoked it to praise the poetic craft that deals only with inspired words, the ivory tower became once again an object of ridicule, the egotistical choice of inaction over action, which neither the Third Reich's attempt at recuperation nor Gramsci's inspired call to intellectual arms was entirely successful in overturning. Today, the reader in the ivory tower has become emblematic of yet another position. At a time when the values that our societies put forward as desirable are those of speed and brevity, the slow, intense, reflective process of reading is seen as inefficient and old-fashioned. Electronic reading of various kinds, and I don't want to appear as the someone who thinks of the electronic media as the Antichrist. I'm sorry. Yesterday, of course, I needed to make a reference to the change of the notions of reading and travel, and of course had to make reference to the vocabulary we use when we do electronic reading. And now I have to come back to that notion, because electronic reading of various kinds does not seem to encourage prolonged sessions with a single text, but rather a pecking process of short fragments. Communications historian Nicholas Carr, in a book called The Shallows, speaks of certain digital media scholars who suggest that, I quote, "We shouldn't waste our time mourning the death of deep reading. It was overrated all along." And they go on to judge War and Peace and In Search of Lost Time as too long and not so interesting. Well, while not taking these postures too seriously, Carr identifies such declarations as important signs of the shift that is taking place in society's attitude towards intellectual achievement. And I think he says something very important here. Their words, I'm quoting Carr, their words make it a lot easier for people to justify that shift, to convince themselves that surfing the web is a suitable, even superior substitute for deep reading and other forms of calm and attentive thought. In arguing that books are archaic and dispensable, these critics provide the intellectual cover that allows thoughtful people to slip comfortably into the permanent state of distractedness that defines the online life. So far, Carr. I will just conclude with this, that what Carr is defining is, in fact, to bind themselves in nutshells and count themselves kings of infinite space. Thank you.
Someone behind you. Yeah.
Thank you.
this is a little removed from your comments, but it's related to the whole thing. In his travel book, Paul Theroux tells how he's in his travels to Patagonia.
Old Patagonia Express.
He stops in Buenos Aires to meet Jorge Luis Borges. And actually, he stays on as a reader for I don't remember how many weeks. But he ends up being in awe of Borges. Now, obviously, you see the question coming. Four years you were a reader, it said, for Borges. I wondered if you could just share some idea, what languages you read to him in and how it might have been transformational. I mean, why are you the writer that you are today, and what influence did he have on you?
I'll begin by saying that when Borges became blind in the mid-50s, his mother acted as his secretary and read for him. In fact, there is a very amusing sequence in a French documentary where they're speaking French, and his mother spoke French with an Argentinian accent. And at one point, she wants to say that she had been her husband's hand, and now she was her son's hand writing for him. But in French, she says, "J'étais la main de mon mari, et je suis maintenant l'amant de mon fils," his lover rather than his hand. And she was that up to a certain point. But she was an elderly lady and became tired very quickly. And so Borges would ask everyone to read for him. Everyone, the postman, the guy at the cafe, somebody he met in the street, and so on. So I did read for him. I worked in an English-German bookstore while I was going to high school, and Borges would come and buy his books there. And then one day he asked me if I would come and read for him, but not because of anything I was or because of my voice or because of any. He just asked anyone because he needed someone else's eyes to read for him. Borges asked me to read at a particular moment in his life. This was in the mid-60s. Borges had decided when he became blind that he would no longer write prose. He would only write poetry, which he could compose in his head and then dictate as a whole. Then in the mid-60s, he thought that perhaps he should try, but he didn't tell anyone, and he imagined some plots for stories. But before setting out to write them, he wanted to go back to the stories that were for him models of perfection in fiction and inspect them as a mechanic would inspect a car to see how the thing works. And so he would ask me to read to him English, French, Spanish, and German, but we would never get very far. We would read a story by Léon Blois or a story by Stevenson, and we would get to the second or third sentence, and he would say, this word, look how he's using it at this point, and it will come back three pages later in another context. And he was looking at it from the point of view of a craftsman, what he called a maker, going back to the old Anglo-Saxon word for poet. At first, I mean, I was 15, 16 years old. I thought that he wanted a dialogue of some sort. He had the tick of his generation, which was to end his comments with a question, right? And so I would answer that, right? And I very soon realized that he did not want an answer. So I would simply listen to his comments. I I didn't know at the time that I had the immense privilege of being the witness of one of the great readers of the history of literature, someone who in my mind defines literature, and there is a way of reading literature before Borges and after Borges. But of course at the time I thought I was just helping a nice old gentleman who was blind.
Other questions?
I wonder if you could tell us the ivory tower when Rubén Darío used it, because
when Rubén Darío used it, yeah. But that is later, and Darío is using it. I think he uses it in his poem on Verlaine, doesn't he? Liróforo celeste and so on, and I think he uses it as part of a modernist rhetorical enumeration. I don't know that he thought very carefully about the meaning, but I don't think for Darío it had a negative connotation. I haven't looked into that.
Hello. You talked a little bit about the intellectual and the ivory tower and how the intellectual is in some way unable to take action, particularly in the case of Hamlet. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Benjamin's idea of the flâneur in Baudelaire and how the flâneur is someone who engages with the crowd and who's critically engaged with the crowd, but is also very active in the sense that he's walking around the streets of Paris. How does that idea of activity mesh with this idea of the intellectual as well in Benjamin as opposed to, say, Hamlet?
Of course, it's a different metaphor. It relates more to my talk yesterday about the reader as traveler. I didn't go into the notion of flâneur, the Baudelaire, Benjamin, and so on. It's a different way of conceiving the notion of reading. And in the case of Benjamin, of course, it is the reading of the physical city. But I think I spoke about that yesterday, so I wouldn't want to go back to that, but it is another metaphor, and certainly one that represents the reader as someone active instead of the ivory tower, which represents the reader as someone sitting and just concentrating on his books.
Thank you very much. Could you talk about reading out loud as an activity?
Mm-hmm. Yes, even though it doesn't relate, I think, to the notion of the ivory tower. But well, if I go back to my experience with Borges, I think one aspect of reading out loud that I realized is that there is a myriad ways of reading out loud. There is the reading out loud that you do for an audience as the author, for instance, Dickens, where your reading carries an interpretation that has the authority that comes from the fact that the person reading out loud is the author. There is the reading out loud that you perform for friends or for your family or for a child going to bed at night, where you read something also from a position of authority, but where you're sharing your taste with that audience. You have the reading out loud where you are contracted to read, as for instance in the cigar rolling factories in Cuba, where the workers would pay someone to come and read for them, which is has a medieval precedent in the Evangile de Quenouille. The women ask a man to come and read to them while they spin. In the case of reading, there are many more. In the case of reading out loud for Borges, it was very clear that he wanted no interpretation. The choice was certainly not mine. And the tone or the importance attributed to the text was all in his hands, not in mine. So he would decide whether it was good or bad, whether the text was good or bad, or whether this was an important moment. All the comments were his. So there are different ways of putting the text out. And we could go on this subject for a very long time. It's fascinating.
Other questions?
Okay. Over here? Yeah. Oh, sorry. Sorry. I only had eyes for David.
I'm wondering, were you to stage a production of Hamlet? How would you stage the scene in which Hamlet enters reading, Ophelia asks him what he is reading, and he answers, words, words, words.
I have not thought of staging Hamlet. It probably belongs to the long, long list of things I will never do. I imagine that Hamlet is doing two things at the same time. On the one hand, he's not pretending to read. He is a reader. George Steiner suggests that he's reading Florio's translation of Montaigne, which is a very nice idea. But he's obviously not going to engage in an intellectual discussion with Ophelia and with Polonius, and certainly not at that moment. He has no respect for Polonius, and he wants to pretend that he's mad. So words, words, words. We can interpret that as a reflection on the vacuity of the intellectual enterprise, a sort of a pre-echo of Faust, or even of Mallarmé, J'ai lu tous les livres, and this is sort of all words, words, words. Or is simply a way of saying to Polonius, I am mad, and whatever I say, you can interpret. It will sound reasonable if you put the right interpretation to it, but I am mad, and so I will say whatever comes first into my head. I did see a wonderful production in Argentina of Hamlet. Many things didn't work about it, but one thing that worked about that scene was that it was played off stage. So the stage was empty, and you simply heard them have that exchange. So you weren't quite sure. It added another level to the uncertainty of Hamlet's reading, because you didn't know if he was carrying a book or what was happening.
When you were reading for Borges, was it a new work that he asked you to read, or was it a work with which he was familiar?
It was always a work with which he was familiar, which in fact he knew by heart. And he knew by heart to the point that, for instance, we would read a Kipling story, and he remembered having seen it in the magazine in which it was first published during Kipling's lifetime when he was an adolescent, and the magazine arrived in his house, and he remembered the illustration and whether it was on the right-hand side of the page and so on. He had an extraordinary memory. He pretended not to, so that when journalists would quote something of his, he would pretend he didn't remember. But if they made a mistake in quoting it, he would certainly correct them. What he wanted to look at texts that he knew very well, and see how they functioned. So it was all stories that were his favorites.
I think we have time for perhaps one more question. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
I would like to just mention that if you're interested, Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age is available for sale from Amazon. Tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. in the Meyerson Conference Room or Center in the Van Pelt Library, Alberto Manguel has graciously offered 2 hours of his time to meet with students and interested individuals. So if you're free from 10 to 12 tomorrow, please join us in the Meyerson Conference Room for a more informal discussion about reading or porques or whatever may arise in the course of the discussion. I'd also like to remind you that on Thursday evening at 5:30, we are meeting in the library in the class of 55 lecture room. So thank you again for coming this evening, and we look forward to seeing you either tomorrow morning or, I hope, on Thursday. Thanks very much.